God's Gods by Terry Pratchett. Part 4. No one knows why dwarfs who, at home in the mountains, lead quiet, orderly lives, forget it all when they move to the big city. Something comes over even the most blameless iron ore miner, and prompts him to wear chainmail all the time, carry an axe, change his name to something like Grabthroat Shin-Kicker, and drink himself into a surly oblivion. It's probably because they do live such quiet and orderly lives back at home. After all, probably the first thing a young dwarf wants to do when he hits the big city after 70 years of working for his father at the bottom of a pit is have a big drink and then hit someone. The fight was one of those enjoyable dwarfish fights with about 100 participants and 150 alliances. The screams, oaths, and the ringing of axes on iron helms mingled with the sounds of a drunken group by the fireplace, who, another dwarfish custom, were singing about gold. Nobby bumped into the back of Carrot, who was watching the scene with horror.
"Look, it's like this every night in here," said Nobby. "Don't interfere, that's what the sergeant says. It's their ethnic folkways or something. You don't go messing with ethnic folkways."
But... Carrot stuttered. "These are my people." "Sort of. It's shameful acting like this. What must everyone think?"
"We think they're mean little buggers," said Nobby. "Now come on."
But Carrot had waded into the scuffling mass. He cupped his hands around his mouth and bellowed something in a language Nobby didn't understand. Practically any language, including his native one, would have fitted that description, but in this case it was dwarfish.
"Gratzak! Gratzak! Akazet Azim! Kabur Kazak Tazim!"
The fighting stopped. 100 bearded faces glared up at Carrot's stooped figure, their annoyance mingled with surprise. A battered tankard bounced off his breastplate. Carrot reached down and picked up the struggling figure without apparent effort.
"Jauk, yatruz tarud et zula. Hradzak dezek drezhok. Hazukarazok batatusa. Gekek meek tapatazink. Betek."
No dwarf had ever heard so many old tongue words from the mouth of anyone over 4 feet high. They were astonished. Carrot lowered the offending dwarf to the floor. There were tears in his eyes. "You're dwarfs," he said. "Dwarfs shouldn't be acting like this. Look at you all. Aren't you ashamed?" 100 bone-hard jaws dropped. "I mean, look at you," Carrot shook his head. "Can you imagine what your poor, white-bearded old mother slaving away back in a little hole, wondering how her son is getting on tonight? Can you imagine what she'd think if she saw you now? Your own dear mother's, who first showed you how to use a pickaxe." Nobby, standing by the doorway in terror and amazement, was aware of a growing chorus of nose-blowings and muffled sobs as Carrot went on. "She's probably thinking, I expect he's having a quiet game of dominoes or something." A nearby dwarf, wearing a helmet encrusted with 6-inch spikes, started crying gently into his beer. "And I bet it's been a long time since any of you wrote her a letter too, and you promised to write every week." Nobby absent-mindedly took out a grubby handkerchief and passed it to a dwarf who was leaning against a wall, shaking with grief. "Now then," said Carrot kindly, "I don't want to be hard on anyone, but I shall be coming past here every night from now on, and I shall expect to see proper standards of dwarf behaviour. I know what it's like when you're far from home, but there's no excuse for this sort of thing." He touched his helmet.
"Gahalak tuk!"
He gave them all a bright smile and half-walked, half-crouched out of the bar. As he emerged into the street, Nobby tapped him on the arm.
"Don't you ever do nothing like that to me again," he fumed. "You're in the city watch. Don't give me any more of this law business."
"But it is very important," said Carrot seriously, trotting after Nobby as he sidled into a narrower street.
"Not as important as staying in one pace," said Nobby. "Dwarf bars, if you've got any sense, my lad, you'll come in here and shut up."
Carrot stared up at the building they had reached. It was set back a little from the mud of the street. The sounds of considerable drinking were coming from inside. A battered sign hung over the door. It showed a drum.
"A tavern, is it?" said Carrot thoughtfully. "Open at this hour?" Don't see why not, said Nobby, pushing open the door. Damn useful idea, the mended drum.
And more drinking?
Carrot thumbed hastily through the book. I hope so, said Nobby.
He nodded to the troll who was employed by the drum as a splatter.
Evening, detritus, just showing the new lad the ropes.
The troll grunted and waved a crusted arm.
The inside of the mended drum is now legendary as the most famous disreputable tavern on the Discworld, and such a feature of the city that after recent unavoidable redecorations, the new owner spent days recreating the original pattern of dirt, soot, and less identifiable substances on the walls, and imported a ton of pre-rotted rushes for the floor. The drinkers were the usual bunch of heroes, cutthroats, mercenaries, desperados, and villains, and only microscopic analysis could have told which was which. Thick coils of smoke hung in the air, perhaps to avoid touching the walls. The conversation dipped fractionally as the two guards wandered in, and then rose to its former level. A couple of cronies waved to Nobby. He realised Carrot was busy.
"What you doing?" he said. "And no talking about mothers, right?"
"I'm taking notes," said Carrot grimly. "I've got a notebook."
"That's the ticket," said Nobby. "You like this place. I comes here every night for me supper."
"How do you spell contravention?" said Carrot, turning over a page.
"I don't," said Nobby, pushing through the crowds, a rare impulse to generosity lodged in his mind. "What do you want to drink?"
"I don't think that would be very appropriate," said Carrot. "Anyway, strong drink is a mocker."
He was aware of a penetrating stare at the back of his neck, and turned and looked into the big, bland and gentle face of an orangutan. It was seated at the bar with a pint mug and a bowl of peanuts in front of it. It tilted its glass amicably towards Carrot and then drank deeply and noisily by apparently forming its lower lip into some sort of prehensile funnel and making a noise like a canal being drained. Carrot nudged Nobby.
"There's a monk," he began. "Don't say it," said Nobby urgently. "Don't say the word. It's the librarian. Works at the university. Always comes down here for a nightcap of an evening."
"And people don't object?"
"Why should they?" said Nobby. "He always stands his round just like everyone else."
Carrot turned and looked at the ape again. A number of questions pressed for attention, such as where does it keep its money? The librarian caught his gaze, misinterpreted it, and gently pushed the bowl of peanuts towards him. Carrot pulled himself to his full, impressive height and consulted his notebook. The afternoon spent reading the laws and ordinances had been well spent. "Who is the owner, proprietor, lessee, or landlord of these premises?" he said to Nobby.
"What's that?" said the small guard. "Landlord? Well, I suppose Charlie is in charge tonight. Why?"
He indicated a large, heavy-set man whose face was a net of scars. Its owner paused in the act of spreading the dirt more evenly around some glasses by means of a damp cloth, and gave Carrot a conspiratorial wink.
"Charlie, this is Carrot," said Nobby. "He's stopping along the Rosy Palms."
"What, every night?" said Charlie.
Carrot cleared his throat. "If you are in charge," he intoned, "then it is my duty to inform you that you are under arrest."
"Arrest to what, friend?" said Charlie, still polishing.
"Under arrest," said Carrot, "with a view to the presentation of charges to wit, one eye, that on or about 18th of Groon, at a place called The Mended Drum, Filigree Street, you did A, serve, or B, did cause to serve, alcoholic beverages after the hours of 12 midnight, contrary to the provisions of the Public Ale Houses Opening Act of 1678, and 1II, on about the 18th of Groon, at a place called the Mended Drum, Filigree Street, you did serve or did cause to serve alcoholic beverages in containers other than a size and capacity laid down by aforesaid Act, and 2I, that on about 18th Groon, at a place called the Mended Drum, Filigree Street, you did allow customers to carry unsheathed, edged weapons of a length greater than 7 inches, contrary to Section 3 of said Act, and 2II, that on or about 18th Groon, at a place called the Mended Drum, Filigree Street, you did serve alcoholic beverages in premises apparently unlicensed for the sale and or consumption of said beverages, contrary to Section 3 of the aforesaid Act." There was a dead silence as Carrot turned over another page and went on. "It is also my duty to inform you that it is my intention to lay evidence before the justices with a view to the consideration of charges under the Public Foregatherings Gambling Act 1567, the Licensed Premises Hygiene Acts of 1433, 1456, 1463, 1465, and 1470 through 1690, and also
He glanced sideways at the librarian, who knew trouble when he heard it coming, and was hurriedly trying to finish his drink. "The Domestic and Domesticated Animals Care and Protection Act, 1673." The silence that followed held a rare quality of breathless anticipation, and the assembled company waited to see what would happen next. Charlie carefully put down the glass, whose smears had been buffed up to a brilliant shine, and looked down at Nobby. Nobby was endeavouring to pretend that he was totally alone and had no connection whatsoever with anyone who might be standing next to him and coincidentally wearing an identical uniform.
"What do you mean, justices?" he said to Nobby. "There ain't no justices."
Nobby gave a terrified shrug.
"New, is he?"
said Charlie.
"Make it easy on yourself," said Carrot.
"This is nothing personal, you understand," said Charlie to Nobby. "It's just a what's name. Had a wizard in here the other night talking about it, sort of bendy educational thing, you know."
He appeared to think for a minute.
"Learning curve, that was it. It's a learning curve. Detritus, get your big stony arse over here a moment."
Generally, about this time in the mended drum, someone throws a glass, and in fact, this now happened. Captain Vimes ran up Short Street, the longest in the city, which shows the famous Ankh-Morpork Pork subtle sense of humour in a nutshell. With Sergeant Colon stumbling along behind, protesting. Nobby was outside the drum, hopping from one foot to another. In times of danger he had a way of propelling himself from place to place without apparently moving through the intervening space, which could put any ordinary matter transporter to shame.
"He's fighting in there,"
he stuttered, grabbing the captain's arm.
"All by himself?" said the captain.
"No, with everyone,"
shouted Nobby, hopping from one foot to the other.
"Oh."
Conscience said, "There's three of you. He's wearing the same uniform. He's one of your men. Remember poor old Gaskin." Another part of his brain, the hated, despicable part, which had nevertheless enabled him to survive in the guards these past 10 years, said, "It's rude to butt in. We'll wait till he's finished, and then ask him if he wants any assistance. Besides, it isn't watch policy to interfere in fights. It's a lot simpler to go in afterwards and arrest anyone recumbent." There was a crash as a nearby window burst outward and deposited a stunned fighter on the opposite side of the street.
"I think," said the captain carefully, "that we'd better take prompt action." "That's right," said Sergeant Curlon. "A man could get hurt standing here."
They sidled cautiously a little way down the street, where the sound of splintering wood and breaking glass wasn't so overpowering, and carefully avoided one another's eyes. There was the occasional scream from within the tavern, and every now and again a mysterious ringing noise as though someone was hitting a gong with their knee. They stood in a little pool of embarrassed silence.
"You had your holidays this year, Sergeant,"
said Captain Vimes eventually, rocking back and forth on his heels.
"Yes, sir. Sent the wife to Quirm last month, sir, to see her aunt."
"Very nicest time of year, I'm told."
"Yes, sir."
"All the geraniums and what not?"
A figure tumbled out of an upper window and crumpled on the cobbles.
"That's where they've got that floral sundial, isn't it?" said the captain desperately.
"Yes, sir. Very nice, sir. All done with little flowers, sir."
There was a sound like something hitting something else repeatedly with something heavy and wooden. Vimes winced.
"I don't think he'd have been happy in the watch, sir,"
said the sergeant in a kindly voice. The door of the mended drum had been torn off during riots so often that specially tempered hinges had recently been installed, and the fact that the next tremendous crash tore the whole door and doorframe out of the wall only showed that quite a lot of money had been wasted. A figure in the midst of the wreckage tried to raise itself on its elbows, groaned, and slumped back.
"Well, it would seem that's all," the captain began, and Nobby said,
"It's that bloody troll."
"What?"
said Vimes.
"It's that troll, the one they have on the door."
They advanced with extreme caution. It was indeed Detritus the Splatter. It is very difficult to hurt a creature that is, to all intents and purposes, a mobile stone. Someone seemed to have managed it, though. The fallen figure was groaning like a couple of bricks being crushed together.
"That's a turn-up for the books,"
said the sergeant vaguely. All three of them turned and peered into the brightly lit rectangle, where the doorway had been. Things had definitely quieted down a bit.
"You don't think," said the sergeant, "that he's winning, do you?"
The captain thrust out his jaw.
"We owe it to our colleague and fellow officer," he said, "to find out."
There was a whimper from behind them. They turned and saw Nobby hopping on one leg and clutching a foot. "What's up with you, man?" said Vimes. Nobby made an agonised noise. Sergeant Colon began to understand. Although cautious obsequiousness was the general tone of watch behaviour, there wasn't one member of the entire squad who hadn't, at some time, been at the wrong end of Detritus's fists. Nobby had merely tried to play catch-up in the very best tradition of policemen everywhere.
"You went and kicked him in a rock, sir," he said.
"Disgraceful," said the captain vaguely. He hesitated.
"Do trolls have rocks?" he said.
"Take it from me, sir."
"Good grief," said Vimes. "Dame Nature moves in strange ways, doesn't she?"
"Right you are, sir," said the sergeant
obediently. "And now," said the captain, drawing his sword, "forward."
"Yes, sir."
"This means you too, sergeant," the captain added.
"Yes, sir."
It was possibly the most circumspect advance in the history of military manoeuvres, right down at the bottom end of the scale that things like the charge of the Light Brigade are at the top of. They peered cautiously around the ravished doorway. There were a number of people sprawled across the tables, or what remained of the tables. Those who were still conscious looked unhappy about it. Carrot stood in the middle of the floor. His rusty chainmail was torn, his helmet was missing, he was swaying a little from side to side, and one eye was already starting to swell. But he recognised the captain, dropped the feebly protesting customer he was holding, and threw a salute.
"Beg to report 31 offences of making an affray, sir, and 56 cases of riotous behaviour, 41 offences of obstructing an officer of the watch in the execution of his duty, 13 offences of assault with a deadly weapon, 6 cases of malicious lingering, and Corporal Nobby hasn't even shown me one rope yet."
He fell backward, breaking a table. Captain Vimes coughed. He wasn't at all sure what he was supposed to do next. As far as he knew, the watch had never been in this position before.
"I think you should get him a drink, Sergeant," he said.
"Yes, sir."
"And get me one, too."
"Yes, sir."
"Have one yourself, why don't you?"
"Yes, sir."
"And you, Corporal, will you please—" "What are you doing?"
"Searching the body, sir," said Nobby quickly, straightening up. "For incriminating evidence and that."
"In their money pouches?"
Nobby thrust his hand behind his back.
"You never know, sir," he said.
The sergeant had located a miraculously unbroken bottle of spirits in the wreckage and forced a lot of its contents between Carrot's lips.
"What are we going to do with all this lot, Captain?"
he said over his shoulder.
"I haven't the faintest idea," said Vimes, sitting down.
The watch jail was just about big enough for 6 very small people, which were usually the only sort to be put in. Whereas these... He looked around him desperately. There was Nork the Impaler, lying under a table and making bubbling noises. There was Big Henry. There was Grabber Simmons, one of the most feared barroom fighters in the city. All in all, there were a lot of people it wouldn't pay to be near when they woke up.
"We could cut their throats, sir," said Nobby,
veteran of a score of residual battlefields. He had found an unconscious fighter, who was about the right size and was speculatively removing his boots, which looked quite new and about the right size.
"That would be entirely wrong," said Vimes. He wasn't sure how you actually went about cutting a throat. It had never hitherto been an option. "No," he said, "I think perhaps we'll let them all off with a caution." There was a groan from under the bench. "Besides," he went on quickly, "we should get our fallen comrade to a place of safety as soon as possible."
"Good point," said the sergeant.
He took a swig of the spirits for the sake of his nerves. The two of them managed to sling Carrot between them and guide his wobbling legs up the steps. Vimes, collapsing under the weight, looked around for Nobby.
"Corporal Nobbs," he rasped, "why are you kicking people when they're down?"
"Safest way, sir," said Nobby.
Nobby had long ago been told about fighting fair and not striking a fallen opponent, and had then given some creative thought to how those rules applied to someone 4 feet tall with the muscle tone of an elastic band.
"Well, stop it. I want you to caution the felons," said the captain. "Well, stop it. I want you to caution the felons," said the captain.
"How, sir?"
"Well, you..."
Captain Vimes stopped.
He was blowed if he knew. He'd never done it.
"Just do it," he snapped. "Surely I don't have to tell you everything."
Nobby was left alone at the top of the stairs. A general muttering and groaning from the floor indicated that people were waking up. Nobby thought quickly. He shook an admonitory cheese straw of a finger.
"Let that be a lesson to you," he said. "Don't do it again."
And ran for it. Up in the darkness of the rafters, the librarian scratched himself reflectively. Life was certainly full of surprises. He was going to watch developments with interest.
He shelled a thoughtful peanut with his feet and swung away into the darkness. The Supreme Grand Master raised his hands.
Are the thuribles of destiny ritually chastised that evil and loose thinking may be banished from this sanctified circle?
Yep. The Supreme Grand Master lowered his hands.
Yep, he said.
Yep, said Brother Dunnikin happily. Done it myself.
You are supposed to say yea, O Supreme One, said the Supreme Grand Master. Honestly, I've told you enough times, if you are not all going to enter into the spirit of the thing.
Yes, you listen to what Supreme Grand Master tells you, said Brother Watchtower, glaring at the errant brother. We'll spend hours chastising them thuribles, muttered Brother Dunnikin.
Carry on, O Supreme Grand Master, said Brother Watchtower. Very well, then, said the Grand Master. Tonight we'll try another experimental summoning. I trust you have obtained suitable raw materials, brothers.
Scrubbed and scrubbed. Not that you got any thanks.
All sorted out, Supreme Grand Master, said Brother Watchtower.
It was, the Grand Master conceded, a slightly better collection. The brothers had certainly been busy. Pride of place was given to an illuminated tavern sign whose removal, the Grand Master thought, should have merited some sort of civic award. At the moment, the E was a ghastly pink and flashed on and off at random.
I got that, said Brother Watchtower proudly. They thought I was mending it or something, but I took my screwdriver and I...
Yes, well done, said Supreme Grand Master. Shows initiative.
Thank you, Supreme Grand Master, beamed Brother Watchtower. Knuckles all rubbed raw, all red and cracked. Never even got me $3 back either. No one so much as says.
And now, said the Supreme Grand Master, taking up the book, we will begin to commence. Shut up, Brother Dunnikin.
Every town in the multiverse has a part that is something like Ankh-Morpork's shades. It's usually the oldest part, its lanes faithfully following the original tracks of medieval cows going down to the river. And they have names like the Shambles, the Rookery, Schnigg's Alley. Most of Ankh-Morpork is like that in any case, but the Shades was even more so, a sort of black hole of a bread-in-the-brickwork lawlessness. Put it like this, even the criminals were afraid to walk the streets. The Watch didn't set foot in it. They were accidentally setting foot in it now, not very reliably. It had been a trying night and they'd been steadying their nerves. They were now so steady that all four were relying on the other three to keep them upright and steer. Captain Vimes passed the bottle back to the sergeant.
Shame on, he thought for a bit. You, he said. Drown in front of a super-super-super-facilla.
The sergeant tried to speak, but could only come out with a series of S's.
Put yourself on a charge, said Captain Vimes, rebounding off a wall. He glared at the brickwork. This wall assaulted me, he declared. Ha! Think you're tough, eh? Well, I'm an officer of the law, I'll have you know. And we don't take any...
He blinked slowly, once or twice.
What is it we don't take any of, son? He said.
Chances, sir, said Colon.
No, other stuff. Never mind. Anyway, we don't take any of it from anyone.
Vague visions were trotting through his mind. A room full of criminal types, people that had jeered at him, people whose very existence had offended and taunted him for years, lying around and groaning. He was a little unclear on how it happened, but some almost forgotten part of him, some much younger Vimes with a bright shining breastplate and big hopes, a Vimes he thought the alcohol had long ago drowned, was suddenly restless.
Shall I tell you something, sergeant? He said.
Sir?
The four of them bounced gently off another wall and began another slow crabwise waltz across the city.
This city, sergeant. This is a woman, sergeant. Sir, is a woman. Ancient, riddled old beauty, sergeant. But if you fall in love with her, then she'll kick you in the teeth.
It's a woman,
said Colon. He screwed up his sweating face with the effort of thought.
Say it miles wide, sir. It's got a river in it. Lots of houses and stuff, sir. He reasoned.
Ah! Vimes waggled an unsteady finger at him. Never said it was a small woman, did I? Be fair.
He waved the bottle. Another random thought exploded in the front of his mind.
"We showed him anyway,"
he said excitedly as the four of them began an oblique shuffle back to the opposite wall.
"Showed him, didn't we? Taught them a forget they won't listen in a hurry, eh?"
"That's right,"
said the sergeant, but not very enthusiastically. He was still wondering about his superior officer's sex life. But Vimes was in the kind of mood that didn't need encouragement.
"Ha!" he shouted at the dark alleyways. "Don't like it, eh? Taste it, your own medicine thingy? Well, now you can boogle it in your trems."
He threw his empty bottle into the air.
2 o'clock, he yelled, and all's well.
Which was astonishing news to the various shadowy figures who had been silently shadowing the four of them for some time. Only sheer puzzlement had prevented them making their attention sharp and plain. These people are clearly guards, they were thinking. They've got the right helmets and everything, and yet they are here in the shades. So they were being watched with the fascination that a pack of wolves might focus on a handful of sheep, who had not only trotted into the clearing, but were making playful butts and baaing noises. The outcome was of course going to be mutton, but in the meantime inquisitiveness gave a stay of execution. Carrot raised his muzzy head.
"Where are we?" he groaned.
"On our way home," said the sergeant.
He looked up at the pitted, worm-eaten and knife-scored signs above them.
"We're just going down," he squinted. "Sweetheart Lane."
"Sweetheart Lane's not on the way home," slurred Nobby. "We wouldn't want to go down Sweetheart Lane, it's in the shades. Catch us going down Sweetheart Lane."
There was a crowded moment, in which realisation did the icy work of a good night's sleep and several pints of black coffee. The three of them, by unspoken agreement, clustered up towards Carrot.
"What are we going to do, Captain?" said Colon.
"We could call for help," said the captain uncertainly.
"What, here?"
"You've got a point."
"I reckon we must have turned left out of Silver Street instead of right," quavered Nobby.
"Well, that's one mistake we won't make again in a hurry," said the captain. Then he wished he hadn't. They could hear footsteps. Somewhere off to their left, there was a snigger.
"We must form a square," said the captain. They all tried to form a point. "Eh? What was that?"
said Sergeant Colon.
"What?" "There it was again. Sort of leathery sound."
Captain Vimes tried not to think about hoods and garrotting. There were, he knew, many gods. There was a god for every trade. There was a beggar's god, a whore's goddess, a thieves' god, probably even an assassin's god. He wondered whether there was, somewhere in that vast pantheon, a god who would look kindly on hard-pressed and fairly innocent law enforcement officers who were quite definitely about to die. There probably wasn't, he thought bitterly. Something like that wasn't stylish enough for gods. Catch any god worrying about any poor sod trying to do his best for a handful of dollars a month. Not them. Gods went overboard for smart bastards whose idea of a day's work was prizing the ruby eye of the earwig king out of its socket, not for some unimaginative sap who just pounded the pavement every night.
"More sort of slithery,"
said the sergeant, who liked to get things right. And then there was a sound, perhaps a volcanic sound, or the sound of a boiling geyser. But at any rate, a long, dry roar of a sound, like the bellows in the forges of the Titans. But it was not so bad as the light, which was blue-white and the sort of light to print the pattern of your eyeball's blood vessels on the back of the inside of your skull. They both went on for hundreds of years, and then instantly stopped. The dark aftermath was filled with purple images, and once the ears regained an ability to hear, a faint, clinkery sound. The guards remained perfectly still for some time.
"Well, well," said the captain weakly.
After a further pause, he said, very clearly, every consonant slotting perfectly into place, "Sergeant, take some men and investigate that, will you?"
"Investigate what, sir?"
said Colon. But it had already dawned on the captain that if the sergeant took some men, it would leave him, Captain Vimes, all alone.
"No, I've got a better idea. We'll all go," he said firmly.
They all went. Now that their eyes were used to the darkness, they could see an indistinct red glow ahead of them. It turned out to be a wall, cooling rapidly. Bits of calcined brickwork were falling off as they contracted, making little pinging noises. That wasn't the worst bit. The worst bit was what was on the wall. They stared at it. They stared at it for a long time. It was only an hour or two till dawn, and no one even suggested trying to find their way back in the dark. They waited by the wall. At least it was warm. They tried not to look at it. Eventually, Kolon stretched uneasily and said,
"Chin up, Captain. It could have been worse."
Vimes finished the bottle. It didn't have any effect. There were some types of sobriety that you just couldn't budge. "Yes," he said. "It could have been us." The Supreme Grand Master opened his eyes. Once again, he said,
"We have achieved success."
The brethren burst into a ragged cheer. The brethren burst into a ragged cheer. The brothers Watchtower and Fingers linked arms and danced an enthusiastic jig in their magic circle. The Supreme Grand Master took a deep breath. First the carrot, he thought, and now the stick. He liked the stick.
"Silence!" he screamed. "Brother Fingers, Brother Watchtower, cease this shameful display!" he screeched. "The rest of you, be silent!"
They quieted down, like rowdy children who have just seen the teacher come into the room. Then they quieted down a lot more, like children who have just seen the teacher's expression. The Supreme Grand Master let this sink in, and then stalked along their ragged ranks.
"I suppose," he thought, "that we think we've done some magic, do we? Brother Watchtower?"
Brother Watchtower swallowed.
Well, you said we were,
"You haven't done anything yet."
Well, no,
Brother Watchtower trembled.
"Do real wizards leap about after a tiny spell and start chanting, 'Here we go, here we go, here we go,' Brother Watchtower?
Well, we were sort of..."
The Supreme Grand Master spun on his heel.
"And do they keep looking apprehensively at the woodwork, Brother Plasterer?"
Brother Plasterer hung his head. He hadn't realised anyone had noticed. When the tension was twanging satisfactorily, like a bowstring, the Supreme Grand Master stood back.
"Why do I bother?" he said, shaking his head. "I could have chosen anyone. I could have picked the best. But I've got a bunch of children."
Honest, said Brother Watchtower. "We was making an effort. I mean, we was really concentrating, weren't we, lads?"
"Yes," they chorused. The Supreme Grand Master glared at them.
"There's no room in this brotherhood for brothers who are not behind us all the way," he warned.
With almost visible relief, the brethren, like panicked sheep who see that a hurdle has been opened in the fold, galloped towards the opening.
"No worries about that, Your Supremity," said Brother Watchtower fervently.
"Commitment must be our watchword," said Supreme Grand Master.
"Watchword, yeah," said Brother Watchtower.
He nudged Brother Plasterer, whose eyes had strayed onto the skirting board again.
"What? Yeah, watchword, yeah," said Brother Plasterer.
"And trust and fraternity," said the Supreme Grand Master.
"Yeah, and them too," said Brother Fingers.
"So," said the Supreme Grand Master, "if there be anyone here not anxious, yea, eager, to continue in this great work, let him step forward now."
No one moved.
"They're hooked. Ye gods, I'm good at this," thought Supreme Grand Master. "I can play on their horrible little minds like a xylophone. It's amazing, the sheer power of mundanity. Who'd have thought that weakness could be a greater force than strength? But you have to know how to direct it, and I do."
"Very well, then," he said. "And now we will repeat the oath."
He led their stumbling, terrified voices through it, noting with approval the strangled way they said "figgin," and he kept one eye on Brother Fingers, too. He's slightly brighter than the others, he thought. Slightly less gullible, at least. Better make sure I'm always the last to leave. Don't want any clever ideas about following me home.